I have for you now a recording of Dr. Linda Hogan, who is from the University of Dublin. She is an expert on peace and conflict issues. She runs a program at Dublin University on peace and conflict. And I had the privilege of meeting her at the Ecumenical Summer School. And this is our discussion.
I was kindly invited back to the Ecumenical Summer School, and I've taught for a week in Sydney at their summer school, and now I've come down to Melbourne to do the same thing again.
So can you tell us a little bit about the subject that you teach and what sort of issues come up in that?
Well, what we're interested in the school that I belong to is creating a context in which peace issues are taken seriously and peace is accepted as a viable alternative to violence in this world. We recognize that peace very often involves the defense of the innocent, and it involves a fight for justice. But what we're interested in pursuing in our school is exploring non-violent options for pursuing justice in this world.
What do you say to people that think that non-violence is ineffective and that the only way you're going to protect yourself is to take the line of building a bigger military in order to create a sense of fear in the other so they won't attack you, and that creates a stable world? What do you think of that?
Well, I think actually our history has shown that this is actually wrong. What our history has shown us is that force and violence leads to more violence, that we are now in a cycle where violence is presented to us as the only alternative, and yet all we can see is that when revolutionary activity is pursued through violence, inevitably there's a cycle of violence that follows it. And so I would say at the historical level that argument is incorrect. We are in the situation now where we are highly militarized purely because of the failures of those many centuries where military options were only chosen. So I very strongly believe that there are very many examples in our histories, in our different nations, of non-violent action that has been successful. Very often it's been at a local level. Very often it's been hidden. Very often it's been preventative. So, in fact, the success of preventative action and preventative diplomacy means we're not in a situation whereby we need to invoke military power. So I really think that we've been fed a lie about the way in which we need a military. I've been talking over the last few days about an extraordinary book. The book is called The Unconquerable World: Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. That's the title. It's by an American writer called Jonathan Schell. And what he does in this book is makes a very strong argument for the power of nonviolence in history. And he says very clearly that force now will only lead to more force. That's what history has told us. But he also says that if we look carefully, we find another tradition in our histories as well. And that's the history of empires overcome by people power, of people choosing the paths of nonviolence, of people resolving conflict nonviolently and peacefully. And really what we need to do at this juncture in history is to reclaim that history, to recognize its significance, and also to draw hope from it. We know that nonviolence has been effective in many places, even when it's only barely resourced or under-resourced. What would it be like if we were prepared to put in the energy, the huge financial resources, the commitment over a long period of time to non-violent resolution of our conflicts? The world would definitely be a different place.
So if you were the person deemed with the responsibility of creating the change in this way, how would you practically do it?
Well, I think that there's no one way of doing it. I think what we need is people working at a whole host of different levels to change the mindset. I think in our schools, through our history books, we need to be telling the successful stories of nonviolence, the situations that give us hope. I think in our art and in our music, we need to be celebrating peace rather than glorifying violence. I think in the movies and the games that children play, we need to be cultivating respect and mutuality rather than, again, this glorification of the big bangs, the spectacle of violence. We're enthralled to violence. Our culture endlessly presents it to us as valuable, wonderful, extraordinary. And we need to recognize that all we see is the big bang, the spectacle, the fireworks. What we don't see on our screens, and what we really do need to see on our screens, is the casualties of that violence. Our culture has completely obliterated the consequences of violence from its screens, from its comprehension, from its imagination. And those things in particular, I think, are very important if we are to shift the mindset.
Just going back to the idea of violent games, particularly with children, there'll be people out there that will say, look, it doesn't affect my child at all. I can put my child in front of a violent game. They're not going to go out and kill somebody. What would be your response to that?
Well, that's probably right. They're probably not going to go out and kill somebody, and one hopes that that is the case. But I think that violence goes deeper than just the idea of, you know, the most extreme version of taking another person's life. Our culture is premised on this idea that if we want to gain something, if we want to be successful, then we've got to be strong, hard, disregarding other people. We've got to go after what we want at all cost. And that's a form of violence. What our culture doesn't encourage us to do, and what many of these games completely ignore, is the importance of cooperative power. And so it may, the person may well be right, a video game that's about violence does not send someone out later to kill, but what does it do to the person's approach to their life, their relationships, their immediate relationships, their family? Does it promote this idea that if you really want something, you just go and take it? Or does it encourage young children to think cooperatively and to act cooperatively? That's the question, really, not will it send someone out to kill.
Now, I'm going to ask you an interesting question. I met a famous woman here in Australia who's based in the United States, who's very, very actively involved in the anti-nuclear area. And I remember when I went and visited her at her place, the first thing she told me when we walked in the kitchen was, you know what the problem with the world is? And I said, no, what do you think? She said, men. Now, what would be your response to that?
I don't think I would ever have said that to you. But I think, obviously, what she's putting her finger on is something about the way in which men and young boys in particular are socialized into a particular mindset that makes them believe that the best way and the most valuable way to express their masculinity is through violence or through some kind of expression of power over. So I think, you know, she may have put her finger on something there by drawing attention to the link between the way in which men are socialized in many, many cultures to believe that they will only truly be fulfilling their masculine identities if they operate in this way. But I would say that really the hazards exist for all people. You know, we can recognize in ourselves very easily and very quickly when we're prone to anger, when we're likely to lash out, when we're likely to for example, blame someone for something that really is our own fault, when we're likely to externalize the things rather than to try and deal with them. So we can recognize in our experience how we can be inclined to violence ourselves. I think that that is a hazard for human beings. It's part of the ambiguity of being human. And so when our culture promotes that, or even condones it, it's very difficult to resist. And it's even more difficult to resist when we don't actually see that this is the way in which we're socialized. So I would say that violence is a hazard that everybody encounters and that everybody is prone to. And so really I would think that the task of peacemaking and peace building is a task for all human beings and not just for men or for women.